This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Going into their yard, they discovered the world.
Heads up, extreme climate change is coming to your neighborhood. Longtime climate activist Mike Tidwell decided to chronicle the ugly changes around his home in Tacoma Park, Maryland, right on the edge of Washington, D.C. Mike is a longtime author. He's written for National Geographic and the Washington Post. In 2002, he left it all to create a new nonprofit, the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. Of course, he kept publishing some really good books. Tidwell wrote about the hurricane threats to the Gulf before Katrina. Mike spoke to us in 2012, and then again last year, we talked about Hurricane Helene in the Appalachians. His new book is The Lost Trees of Willow Avenue, A Story of Climate and Hope on One American Street. From his home in Maryland, Mike Tidwell, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Alex, it's so great to be with you.
At first, I didn't want to cover this new book. I mean, why look into one place? I was worried it would be boring, and I can say right away, it's not. We forget, though, that we all live somewhere, and that is where climate change really happens. Do you see more focus on what I would call the hyper-local as climate continues to unfold?
I do. I was honestly, when I had this thought experiment, what if I paid attention to my one street, my one block in a town right on the border with D.C. for 1 year, what would I find? I knew that there were things going on all around me, but I was astonished by how much was happening. The book is first and foremost about the decline of really big trees on my block, but I also record people with Lyme disease. I myself have chronic Lyme disease because the ticks aren't killed off in as many numbers in the winters here, flooding. And I think what I'm seeing on my block is what people, if they're encouraged to pay attention, everyone is seeing it wherever they live. So yes, I think everyone sees what happened with the wildfires in California, with Hurricane Helene, but now people are feeling it in the form of basements that flood and loved ones that get sick.
And you do write vividly about seemingly magical impacts of being near giant trees like the oaks of Maryland. I've felt that myself. The ancient Celts in Britain worshipped oak groves. Old German tribes did too. There must be something there. But this isn't just mysticism. You tracked it down. You found we can actually feel and measure the effects. Talk to us about forest bathing.
Yeah, it has been widely established that people just feel better near trees. Patients in hospitals, if you can just see a tree in the distance, your recovery rate is faster. Trees tend to lower our cortisol levels, our stress levels. They improve our immune systems. In my neighborhood, historically, it's a city, Tacoma Park, that's so obsessed with trees. We call ourselves Tree City USA. Most of the streets are named after trees, whether it's willow, dogwood, maple. We're obsessed with trees. And until recently, until really the last 5 or 6 years, our tree canopy, our urban tree canopy, was in pretty good shape. But now, because of fantastic rainfall in 2018 that weakened the roots of our trees, triggered a mold in the soil, and then ambrosia beetles followed through, we are losing so many of our trees. Our tree permit removal rate that the city keeps track of is at least double historic averages. And in recent years, it's been three times the historic average for tree removal of damaged trees. So we're seeing this climate change impact. And it's not me saying it's climate change that's killing our trees. It's the city of Tacoma Park arborists and some of the tree experts in this region who point to wild weather extremes from climate change. So as these trees disappear, one of the questions I ask in my book, if trees make us feel better and boost our immune system and make us happier, what happens when they disappear? What happens when you live on a street that used to have many big trees and then they're gone? And I argue that there's reason to believe that on top of the other health impacts of climate change from Lyme disease and what have you, that our immune systems are generally being weakened because we're losing that contact with trees.
What is Lyme disease? And tell us a little bit more about your own battle with it and the deer.
Yeah, Lyme disease is a bacteria that is spread by ticks. Those ticks can be carried by deer or white-footed mice. And because our winters are so much milder, fewer of the ticks are dying in the winter. And also, we now have deer populations that are just out of control in the mid-Atlantic part of the United States. And those deer are spreading ticks as well. So it's a full-blown epidemic. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency uses Lyme disease as one of its key indicators of climate change. There's such a close connection between warming and tick survival that they use it as an indicator of a changing climate. I got bit by a tick in 2008, was misdiagnosed with this bacteria that can cause muscle stiffness. It can cause, eventually, if it's not treated, paralysis and serious problems. And I was misdiagnosed for years and years. Finally, I was diagnosed in 2014 and discovered I had had multiple tick bites and multiple Lyme infections. And now I have been taking lots of antibiotics off and on for the last 10 years. I also supplement that with acupuncture. But it's a tough disease. If you can't catch it early, it can become chronic, like for me. And it just, it's manageable for me, but it, for example, today I'm experiencing inflammation from Lyme disease. I'm lightheaded. I have arthritic-like symptoms, and it'll come and go. And it's very prominent. In writing this book, I just started asking my neighbors and members of my church and the local Boy Scouts. I was shocked by how many people had been battling tick-borne diseases where I live.
Also wrapped in this book are, well, it's just your experience in the climate movement in the United States and the way that movement has changed. And you kind of outline a compromise there. It seems like, I'm going to say around 2010, Greens realized global warming would not be stopped. So then the new goal was to a kind of a reset to avoiding the worst consequences. But now it seems like things are so advanced, we can't even settle for a good enough world. Is that falling out of reach? Where are we going?
Alex, it's a great question. I've dedicated my life to fighting climate change for the last 23 years now, and we've all just seen the impacts get worse and worse. I mean, for example, you can now throw a dart at a spinning, lacquered globe, and wherever that dart lands, that one little spot on the globe, wherever it is, randomly selected, you can write a whole book about the impacts of climate change right there. And the reason I know that is I just did it. I just wrote a book about the impacts of climate change on my one block in Maryland on the border with D.C. So the impacts are very profound now, and it's very serious how it's affecting us. I wish I could say that clean energy alone could solve this problem. I believe that despite Trump, the clean energy revolution is just unstoppable all over the world. I make that argument in the book. Solar is we're building enough solar every day, a gigawatt, every day around the world, equal to a nuclear power plant. Emissions are going down in Europe. Australia is going to reach nearly 100% clean electricity by 2030. The world is going on. We're going to make the switch to clean energy. The problem is we're just not doing it fast enough. The argument I make is it's too late for clean energy alone to save us. Dr. James Hansen, America's most famous climate scientist, has been sounding that alarm for several years now. We have to, in addition to getting off of carbon, we need to reflect sunlight, he says, from the planet for a few decades. And he's at least appealing for greater research investment in ideas of acting, you know, human beings being like a human volcano and studying whether we could put sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere like volcanoes do. Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines in 1991 cooled the entire planet by more than a degree Fahrenheit for nearly 2 years. Could we do that as human beings? Could we do it safely? Are there other ways to make clouds brighter to reflect more sunlight? Can we, you know, just paint every rooftop and parking lot and street white in the world? Would that help? We need to study these things because I fear that unless we reflect sunlight, we may just reach a point of climate change that we cannot adapt to. There are some who say, what about a direct air capture of carbon? Can't we just suck the carbon out of the air? Unfortunately, that technology today is where solar technology was in the 1970s. It's in its infancy. Maybe it'll make faster strides, but I feel like if we're going to maintain some semblance of a habitable planet and organize human civilization, we need to, in addition to clean energy, reflect some sunlight away from the planet and at least begin studying that.
And you and your friend, the scientist Ning Zeng, found a logical way to help a little bit by reducing all the carbon that would be released as those big tree trunks and branches rotted as they were hauled out of your city and all along the East Coast. In 2008, Dr. Zeng published on carbon sequestration via wood burial. I even heard suggestions humans might need to cut down part of the boreal forest and just bury all the trees to capture more carbon out of the air. Few people supported that. That seems too far. But where dead wood is going to be harvested, and it will be to clean up the woods to stop all these wildfires, it should be buried. How would that help?
Well, Dr. Ning Zeng at University of Maryland lives in my neighborhood, and my question for him was, I invited him to my block to see these massive tree stumps, these great, wonderful oak trees that had died. And I asked him, where are these trees going? Because a lot of the arborists and the tree services tell you, oh, that wood is repurposed. It's turned into wood chips. It's turned into specialty lumber. But Ning Zeng at the University of Maryland said, no, that's not the case. So many trees are dying in the mid-Atlantic that the wood chip market is flooded. There's only so much that can be used for lumber because street trees don't grow super straight. So only about 15% can be repurposed. And the rest is going to landfills or incinerators. And his goal is to, instead of having them decompose rapidly in landfills and elsewhere, we could just systematically bury literally hundreds of millions of tons of these trees worldwide. And in my book, I follow his research and I follow him where he buries the first 100 tons of trees on a farm in Maryland north of Baltimore. Those trees had died on the streets of Baltimore because of extreme weather, and they were piling up in a woodlot, and he took 100 tons to bury them to demonstrate to the world that if you bury them in the right soil, into high clay content soil in the proper circumstances, those trees can stay intact for 1,000 years underground. He calls it reverse coal. In fact, he did a very small study in north near Montreal where digging the tomb to bury some trees, they accidentally hit another tree, a cedar tree that was, they tested it, was 3,000 years old, and it still had bark on it. So his argument is we can sequester carbon for centuries, if not thousands of years, by properly burying them, and that's one way to store carbon and help fight climate change.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with author and climate activist Mike Tidwell. Mike is the founder of Chesapeake Climate Action Network. You discovered the idea of solar shading to cool the Earth came from a Soviet scientist way back in 1974. Global warming was known even then. He said we should mimic volcanoes, as you say. What are your feelings? Could this work?
Well, in my book, The Lost Trees of Willow Avenue, I first chronicle the fact that this was the last thing I wanted to be thinking about in my lifetime. First, I dedicated my life. I've been to jail a dozen times, blocking coal plants, stopping coal plant construction, pipelines, street demonstrations. I've organized rallies in support of clean energy on U.S. Capitol Hill and in state capitals. I've been all in on this. I'm a vegetarian. I have solar on my roof, an electric car, so I'm totally green. But it's not enough. And in my book, I describe this painful realization that if the world of my 27-year-old son is going to look anything like the world we all grew up in, that we have to, again, at least research these ideas. Will it work? In terms of solar radiation modification, in terms of putting sulfur dioxide using high-flying airplanes in the stratosphere in a calculated way, similar to volcanoes, I have not met a single scientist who says it won't work, that it won't cool the planet. Everyone agrees that putting sulfur into the stratosphere will cool the planet. The question is, how much? How do you disperse it? what would be the consequences, known and unknown? The reality is that we've already conducted a lot of experiments on this. One, we have volcano behavior to look at in terms of consequences. We have the fact that burning fossil fuels emits sulfur dioxide as well. It's one of the byproducts of burning fossil fuels. So we have been inadvertently cooling the planet, but it's been masked by the even greater concentration of CO2 that's caused warming. And in fact, now as we get off of fossil fuels, as we clean up, for example, the fuel in shipping, maritime ships around the world, we're seeing that mask come off, and there's less sulfur being put into the atmosphere, and we're getting so-called bonus warming in the atmosphere, which you've had guests who've talked about that. So, yes, it can work. We need to study it and study it and study it and develop a international governance for geoengineering to figure out, yes or no, do the world's nations want to do this? If so, how? And what are the safeguards we have to add if we're going to do it at all?
In 2022, Congress did mandate a plan for research into blocking the sun to reduce warming. I wonder, has that gone ahead, or will Elon Musk's kids just slash that too?
Well, in 2023, the Biden administration issued guidelines on how to do research on this. In 2020, Congress authorized the aspects of the federal government to just measure aerosols in the atmosphere, the various particles that reflect sunlight. And those tests are going on between the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. They do have planes that are just measuring aerosols, in part to see what's already up there. If you were to methodically add sulfur particles to the stratosphere, what's already up there? How much would be needed? Also, by monitoring aerosol levels in the stratosphere, it is a way, and continuing to monitor them, it's a way to know if some rogue nation or rogue individual is adding sulfur of their own or some other aerosol. So we could have an alarm system so we could see if someone's doing this without international approval. But we can also study what's the composition of the stratosphere now, and how might that interact with future efforts to artificially cool the planet through additional aerosols.
Radio EcoShock guest Dr. David Keith estimated as few as 10 aircraft could create a solar shield, releasing about 250,000 tons of sulfur per year in the early phase. So that's something that even Elon Musk could just decide to do and do it. Are there any international regulations, or is there any mechanism to stop him or the dictator of North Korea or anyone who feels like it from shading the earth?
No, there are no international treaties, shockingly, to prevent either a country or an individual from launching sulfur canisters into the atmosphere. I mean, with powerful enough artillery, you could actually shoot sulfur into the atmosphere using your military or your own private airplanes. This is scary, and we should, in my view, have an international treaty that bans any individual or country from doing this. The only way we should ever do it, if we do it, should be through international governance and consensus. But yes, the reality is it is not that expensive to put enough sulfur into the stratosphere to cool the planet and to mimic a volcano. It is not a technological challenge. It is doable. It is affordable for people like Elon Musk, and that should concern us all. And as I say in my book, there are a lot of very responsible scientists who want to investigate this carefully, not have someone just go off and do it casually.
And one of the solutions you write about in your book is distributed agriculture. Some might call it victory gardens or urban farming. Why do we need all of it? It doesn't seem like just having a garden is going to save the world, but it certainly can save each one of us, I think.
Yeah, one of the things I write about my urban street is that as big trees die from extreme weather, and it causes grief, and it impacts us all emotionally, it impacts flooding in my neighborhood, we have cascading impacts of climate change. You know, scientists talk about cascading impacts of climate change globally. When you melt Arctic ice, then you have darker oceans exposed that absorb even more CO2, and you have that feedback loop. Well, we have cascading impacts of climate change on my block. When these really big oak trees die, they're not only gone for shading and comfort for human beings, but when these big rainstorms now come, those root systems are not there to absorb the rain that we're getting. So that greater runoff added to even bigger storms means more rain flows, for example, into the basement of my church, which is a block from my house. And the city government where I live in Tacoma Park has had to spend $45,000 elevating a sidewalk 14 inches, not because the sidewalk needed repair. It was perfectly good. They elevated the sidewalk to create a flood berm, a half-block-long flood berm, to keep water out of the basement preschool of my church. And a lot of that additional water is coming from gaps in the canopy from trees being gone. So we have these cascading impacts. And the silver lining, if you want to call it that, when some of the biggest trees in my neighborhood die, it is very common for solar panels to go up. So a house that was shaded by the tree is now very sunny, and we see a lot of solar panels expanding in my neighborhood. As, tragically, the tree canopy comes down, the positive result is more solar. And also, as trees come down, there's more people gardening in my neighborhood. Right on my block, right across from my street, a 80-year-old willow oak came down in 2023 that I write about in my book, The Lost Trees of Willow Avenue. And my neighbor Dorothy, who's a midwife across the street, she and I started a garden right there on the curb. You know, now we're growing tomatoes and we're growing beans. We're going to expand it. You know, is this enough to feed us? No. But if everyone were to plant gardens in sufficiently sunny places in our urban and suburban neighborhoods, we could create a serious amount of food. In fact, the United States did this during World War II with the so-called victory gardens, where as much as 40% of all fresh produce during the war years were actually produced by gardens on street corners and backyards, even on windowsills. So I comment that in my neighborhood, there are more and more gardens. They're just popping up along street corners and curbsides, and people growing more and more food, in part as a consequence of the tree canopy declining. And this is what we need to do in the long term to make our communities more resilient with climate change, grow more of our food closer to our homes.
And I just want to take a quick second to read a quote from your book, which seems pretty right on for where we are right now. You write, "The larger lesson for the climate movement is still there. Governments can grow ill too. They can fall prey to disease. Like people, like trees, like the planet itself, governments have their own version of an immune system that, when attacked, can either fail or, as on January 6th, narrowly survive," ending that quote. And right now, though, we have the attack on everything green, even the language of climate science. It seems like a pretty sick government in America. I'm hoping Europe, China, and India, and Australia don't fall into that same trap. We need the climate movement to keep going. Will it?
Well, it's a great question. There's no doubt that the Trump administration is waging war on clean energy. The problem that they're going to face is that electric cars are becoming cheaper than internal combustion engine vehicles. Solar is the cheapest energy source in the history of energy. As I said before, we're generating around the world a gigawatt of solar, equal to a nuclear power plant every day. And China is leading that as much as anyone. China is leading on wind and solar. The Europeans are leading on offshore wind. China is building more electric cars than any other country and now exporting them to the world. So no matter what the Trump administration does, it cannot hold back the rest of the world. It cannot hold back many of the blue states in the United States, like California, like my state of Maryland, where I live. Commitments to clean energy, commitments to expanding wind and solar will continue. Now, can the Trump administration slow this down? Yes, they can, but they cannot stop it. They cannot reverse the clean energy revolution. So yes, our country is ailing. Its immune system is being attacked, but I think we'll survive and the world will as well. Because if nothing else, just based on market terms, these technologies are just becoming too convenient, too useful, and too cheap to stop forever.
As we wrap this up, Mike, do you have any parting words for our listeners?
I will say that, like many of your listeners, I have been committed to solving the climate crisis for most of my adult life. I've given everything I can to wind and solar and environmental justice, and this is a tough time. But I, by writing this book, The Lost Trees of Willow Avenue, I went through a grieving process. I reconciled myself to what's possible and what's not possible with many of the tools we've been advocating for. I believe in science. I know that investigating ways to reflect sunlight away from our planet, I think, has promise. We'll see in the coming years. In the meantime, we have to hold the line. We have to stand up and speak the truth on climate. We have to take care of our neighbors right next door. We have to support officials who believe in climate change. Times have been hard before on this planet, during the Great Depression and at other times, and we've gotten through it. And I think we'll get through these challenges from the Trump administration and others, and there is hope at the other end. I believe that.
From Maryland, we've been speaking with author and leading climate activist Mike Tidwell. You can find him at ChesapeakeClimate.org. And on various social media platforms. Mike's new book is The Lost Trees of Willow Avenue, A Story of Climate and Hope on One American Street. It's coming out soon. Mike, I am glad you are still out there, still trying to find a way. Thank you for spending time with us.
Thank you so much, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.